Sairam, dear listeners, a warm good evening and welcome to this week's episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai. It's a beautiful Thursday and it's a happening week here in Prashanti. Tomorrow is the Guru Purnima Festival, a day where we fondly offer gratitude to Swami for gracing our lives by becoming our Sadguru. Just a little more than an hour ago, the first Go Green conference organized by the Shri Satya Sai organization concluded. A couple of days back, we had the International Youth Leadership Program, and of course, I was happy to have the opportunity to share my thoughts with the participants there. And of course, the weekend saw the devotees from Maharashtra and Goa celebrating their most auspicious festival of the Ashadi Ekadashi at Prashanti. And before that, we had the Golden Jubilee celebrations of Swami's first college, which is the Anantapur College for Women. And talking about Golden Jubilees, 50 years ago, Swami celebrated the Guru Purnima Festival in Kampala, Uganda. And Swami's devotees there are observing that occasion with much love and gratitude. So it is an interesting and historical week in Prashanti. Being in the middle of all this only fills us with immense gratitude. The very thought that Swami found our lives worthy to be touched by His love makes life itself so meaningful, isn't it? With that grateful thought, let us offer our most humble pranams at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan. Heading to our program, I have a couple of interesting questions from a listener today. They are general questions, but quite important nevertheless. And in a way, it's a continuation of what we had spoken last week. But before we get to that, I have a quote from an American politician, Brad Henry. I quote, "A good teacher can inspire hope, ignite the imagination, and instill love of learning." End of quote. Well, it's Guru Purnima Day tomorrow, so why not a quote on teachers? The quote explains the nature of a good teacher. But doesn't it hold true even for the universal teacher? Just that what he inspires in us is not just any sort of simple hope, but the hope and confidence to reach the ultimate. I recall what Swami was saying in one of his Samukos discourses that we had taken up as part of the Shravanam Mananam series. Swami spoke at length about the tedious nature of the spiritual path and how it calls for intense focus and diligence. But he concluded by saying, that does not mean that you cannot aspire to reach those heights. He assured us by saying that every one of the sages who had reached the highest were humans just like us. You must believe that if they can, so can you, Swami said. This was the universal master giving us the hope. Swami telling us that he believes in us, that he believes that we have it in us. That is what a good teacher does. He does not give us a false idea of the simplicity of the task at hand, but he encourages us and enthuses us. A good teacher ignites the imagination and instills love of learning. A good teacher does not merely take us through the course, which we will anyway go through. He or she is not a replacement for the course material, isn't it? A good teacher fills us with awe and imagination, makes us see the sparkle we can miss otherwise, thereby making us alive to the opportunities to break from the linear growth curve and progress exponentially. And that has to be done by inspiring a love for learning. Swami often tells us, be prepared to face challenges and tribulations because they are opportunities to learn. Just as a student must be eager to take a test or examination, a sadhaka must delight when he or she has to face challenges, Swami would say. We must develop that love for learning and progressing. So dear listeners, if you are a teacher, see if you are doing all of these points that we mentioned. But we all are students, so when Swami tries to inculcate these ideas and thoughts in us, let us see how eager we are to absorb them. That is probably the best Guru Dakshina we can give our Swami. So before we progress, permit me to read that quote by Brad Henry one more time. I quote, "A good teacher can inspire hope, ignite the imagination, and instill love of learning." Let's then head to the question that we have for this week. As I said, it's a question from a listener, but it's a couple of questions actually, interrelated nevertheless. I have Sister Sumana reading out the question for us. The question is from Sister Yasho from Sydney. So let's listen to the question and let's see what answer we can come up with.
Sai Ram, thank you for your show, The Answering Booth. I have two questions. First, Swami says, don't waste time. What is most important is the present. It is omnipresent. Could you please explain this statement? And second, when we meditate, do we look or do we listen to our inner self? Thank you, Sai Ram.
Thank you, Sister, for that question, and thank you, Sister Sumna, for reading it out for us. As you would have understood, the question is about a very important aspect of Swami's message where Swami says, live in the present. Of course, he would say that, you know, the present is the most important. Don't waste time. This is not an ordinary present. This is an omnipresent. So that's the first part of the question that the listener wants clarity about. And the second one is, of course, when we meditate, do we look or do we listen to our inner self? Though both of these questions appear to be a little distinct and different from each other, I think there is a way by which they're connected. And I don't know if the listener was aware of this when she asked this question. Maybe she was. But I was quite surprised, even as I was preparing this answer, that there's a beautiful connection between the two questions. And of course, more interestingly than that, it's a continuation of what we were speaking last week. When I was answering the question last week about how do we remain cheerful, I was explaining how being in the present, living in the present, is one of the ways of doing that. And I had also mentioned that I have a question on living in the present coming up, and I wasn't aware that it's going to be just the next week. So in a way, it's good because we are able to continue that topic that we had taken up last week without a break. I had spoken about living in the present quite some time back. I think probably the 10th episode of Answering Booth, if I'm not mistaken, was on this question of how do we live in the present. And the question was about specifically, how can you not think about the past, or how can you not think about the future? How is it possible to live in the present without thinking about the past and future? And that's what I'd spoken about. I'd spoken very briefly in that context, and even as I was answering that question, I said, I will dwell on it deeper if I have the opportunity in the form of another question. And so here it is. Probably to start off by giving a context of what was it that I spoke of last week that where I mentioned that living in the present. It was about, we were talking about how we have to keep ourselves preoccupied to remain cheerful. And there are more chances that we will be preoccupied if we live in the present, or it's both ways. We will live more in the present if we keep ourselves preoccupied, especially if we keep our mind preoccupied. And that was one of the key ways of remaining all fresh and cheerful all the while. Now, this idea of what Swami says, this is not a present, this is an omnipresent. I think ever since the first time I heard Swami saying this in a discourse, I was very, very thrilled by this idea of this is not a present, this is not omnipresent. Because it's a very interesting idea. Let me start by quoting a Chinnakatha, which Swami would say, a very interesting Chinnakatha, where the story goes that Yudhishthira is actually doing, he's giving away stuff in charity. There's a huge line in front of him, and he's giving away gold and food and all of that in charity. And I think something happens, either it's the time for the evening sandhya, or the material that he has for distributing is over, and there is a person in front of him, the last person in front of him, he does not have anything to give him. I think that's what it is. He doesn't have anything to give him at that moment. So Yudhishthira tells this Brahmin who is standing in front of him that, sir, please come back tomorrow. I don't have anything to give you. I will give you charity tomorrow. So Bhima, who is there to see the sight, apparently he goes around and orders for a feast. He says, come, let's celebrate. And, you know, there's he calls the ministers and say, let's have a big feast. And the celebrations, the festivity. And Yudhishthira is wondering, what happened? What is all this festivity about? And so he comes and asks Bhima, what is going on? So then Bhima tells everybody, you know, my brother Yudhishthira, he has conquered the future. He has conquered time. And Yudhishthira is wondering, what is all this about? Because then Bhima tells that he has asked this Brahmin to come tomorrow, and my brother seems to be so sure that he is going to be alive tomorrow and he'll be there to give this charity tomorrow. So it means that my brother has conquered time and he has transcended the past, present and future. And that's when Swami would say Yudhishthira realizes the mistake of putting away good work into future, the future which is uncertain. That's what Swami would say. That the future is so uncertain and the past is something which has gone past. There is no way we're going to be able to get back to it. The only thing we can be sure of is this very moment when we are alive. The next moment, what would happen to us? The next day, what would happen to us? The next hour, what would happen to us? We have no clue. Right now, we are alive and that's all we can be sure of. Right? Similarly, how much ever we try, we cannot go even one fraction of a second to the past. That's the reality of life, right? You know, even if you were to say that in the future we start, the science progresses so much and we start time travel, let's say that becomes possible. You might travel to someone's past, but as Swami would say, that even in a classroom when teacher calls out who is there in the class or, you know, takes an attendance call, you say, I am present, right? So Swami would say that you are present there and that's why you can say, I am present. So even if we were to do a time travel, it means that we are present in that past of somebody or in a past of some other time. So even if we were to be in the past, we have to be in that moment. It's a present for us. I don't know if I'm making that clear. So the idea of present itself is closely related to existence. That's why I'm saying that right now I'm alive and I can talk about the present. I don't know about the next moment. I can't say anything about the past moment because it's gone. I can only say that I was alive. But right now is the only moment which is there in my disposal. So there's a very strong connection between this idea of existence and the idea or the concept of now or the present. That's a larger idea. I think I'll come to that right in the end of it. The point is, you know, we can be sure only of the present moment. That is the reality. We can act only in the present moment. We can dream of the future, muse about the past, but both of that we are doing only right now, right? So all through our life, we are only living in the present. Whether are we living in the present in the sense that Swami is speaking? Well, that we'll look at it shortly now, but we are living in the present. We are alive in the present. So our entire life is nothing but a series of presents strung together, if I could put it that way, right? So we are constantly only living in the present, and as long as we live, we are only going to live in moments and moments and moments after presents which are going to come. And that is why Swami says it's an omnipresent, that whichever part of your life you take, whichever you know, aspect of your life, whether it's your childhood, your youth, your you know, your old age, each one of it is nothing but a present moment, right? So that's why Swami says it's not an ordinary present, it's omnipresent, because that's all is. The idea of past and future is only in our mind, right? We have nothing but the present. I don't know how, it's a very, very beautiful concept that Swami says. It's not an ordinary present, that it is an omnipresent, because that is all that exists. The past and future is uncertain, the past is gone. As Swami would say, all we have is nothing but the present. So even if I am lost in thoughts of the past, they are only thoughts of the past in the present. Even if I am dreaming of the future, they are nothing but thoughts of the future, but in the present, right? So that is why Swami says all that we have is present, and we are only living through different moments of now. And that's why it's not an ordinary present, it's omnipresent, it's everywhere. Everybody is only living in the present at that given precise moment. Now the question is, in what context does Swami speak about living in the present? The concept of now, the concept of present, as I'll try to explain as we go through the answers, has got multiple layers of meanings to that. It might be of interest intellectually to us, it might be of interest because it's interesting to understand how our idea of living in the present itself changes if we look at it from different angles. But I think what is more important for us is to see in what context Swami says live in the present, in what context Swami says don't waste time, right? That's what's important to us. So I think we'll dwell as much as possible on that topic before we go a little deeper into this idea of time and what we call the present moment also. I'd mentioned last week that Swami wants us to be happy. That, you know, if I said that being cheerful is a choice, and why do we as Swami's devotees need to be cheerful? It's because Swami wants us to be cheerful, right? And whenever Swami speaks about this idea that he wants us to be happy, there is this very beautiful verse from the Bhagavad Gita that Swami would often quote. And I'm sure you must have heard it from Swami if you've heard Swami's discourses, where Swami quotes this verse from the 12th chapter. In fact, 12th chapter happens to be one of the chapters which Swami quotes a lot from. One of my colleagues, Brother Sai Prakash, who's from the primary school, he would say that even in the primary school, they were taught only the first chapter, only the 12th chapter by heart. That was Swami's instruction, because Swami was so fond of the 12th chapter. Those of you who are not very familiar with the Bhagavad Gita, the 12th chapter is about the description of a devotee, right? It's a very, very beautiful chapter. It's about bhakti yoga. So this particular verse which Swami quotes from the 12th chapter goes, Anapeksha suchir daksha udasino gatavyataha sarvaramba parityagi yomad bhakta same priya. A lot of the verses in this chapter end with his last line, yomad bhakta same priya. That devotee of mine is dear to me. That's the meaning of that last line. And so all the shlokas which end with that devotee is dear to me is nothing but the shloka as a description of what a devotee should be. So this particular shloka why Swami quotes. I'll come to the other words later, but the working phrase for us is udasino gatavyata. Who are those devotees who are dear to me? Swami says udasino gatavyata. Udasino means the one who is free of any concerns, who is actually detached, who is not pulled by the possibilities of the moment, or finding one possibility more likable than the other. A certain sense of detachment, a certain sense of being free from concern. So udasina and gatavyata is one who is not distressed, right? One who is free from distress. So Swami would say that devotee who is not concerned about whether he is, successful or a failure, or he's going to see profit or he's going to see loss, and the one who is a gatavyata, who is not distressed, Swami says, yomad bhakta same priya. Such a devotee is dear to me. And that's why I had mentioned last week that we need to choose to be cheerful, because that's what Swami expects from us. And Swami, of course, goes on to say that you can develop this quality of udasina and gatavyata if you live in the present, if you do not brood over the past, and if you are able to keep yourself away from the worry of the future, then you can develop these two qualities of being unconcerned and being cheerful all the time, right? And Swami says that these are two things that actually stop you from being cheerful. Worry about the past, or brooding over the past, and being cheerful, concerned about the future. And probably a small plug in here. We have a beautiful article, which is a transcript of a talk given by Dr. Goldstein. I think it must be up even as I'm speaking now. It must be available on the website. There he mentions a very beautiful incident of, you know, how he, the first time when he came to Swami, he had this first darshan in Dharmakshetra in Bombay, I think, and then Swami asks him to come to Vrindavan, and then from Vrindavan they come to Prashanti Nilayam. And one of those occasions when Swami has called him for an interview, he comes out of the interview room and sits in the bhajan. He says that there is a sense of inexplicable joy that is welling up in his heart, because this idea that I have come to Swami, I mean, there's nothing more to seek, there's nothing more to achieve in life. This is the end of the journey. You know, that sort of a feeling he's filled with. He's saying that I was so happy, I was so joyous, my heart would have burst with happiness. That's the kind of feeling that he was having. And even as Swami had completed that interview, he came and sat outside for the bhajans, and he was saying that as the bhajans were progressing, he started thinking about his past and whatever he had done over the years. And he was saying that I had done a lot of things which I was not very proud of, which I would probably not like to speak about. So he said that thoughts about those things that he had indulged in started making him feel very, very guilty. And he said, oh God, I don't deserve to be close to Swami. I don't deserve Swami's love. And when this thought started coming, he started thinking about all the things in the past. And he started choking up, you know, and he started crying. He burst out into tears. And he was sitting in the bhajan hall all by himself. You know, he didn't speak to anybody. The bhajans were going on. For anybody else who looks at him must have thought that he's just overwhelmed with the bhajans, or he's just moved with the, you know, the bhajans being sung. But he was actually in this state of mind. And even as he was sobbing like this, he feels a warm hand on his shoulder. He turns back. It's Swami standing there. Swami has apparently come from the back door and he's come up to him. And he looks up to Swami all teary-eyed. And Swami bends down and very softly and swiftly Swami says, let go of the past, let go of the past, and walks away. Right? And so he goes on to say that that's one of the most important lessons that he had learned from Swami. That clearly it's an incident that, you know, here is this joy welling up in your heart that you've come to Swami, the very thought that you're in Swami's presence. I think it happens to so many of us. You can so much relate to that, isn't it? When you have that joy, suddenly that joy is taken away because we are lost in the past. We are thinking about something in the past, either something we have done wrong or something that we feel that we should have got, we have not got, or something that which didn't go right. Whatever it is, something in the past comes and it literally steals away this happiness which is welling up in our heart. So that's why Swami is saying that if you want to develop these qualities of Udasina and Gatavyata, one of the things that you have to do is let go of the past, because there's nothing that you can do in the present that can change your past. There's nothing that you can do which will correct or better what you've done in the past. Right? And similarly, when you're talking about the future, Swami says it's absolutely uncertain, as I was telling about the Chinnakatha, the next moment we don't know if we'll be alive to say that I'm present now, right? We have no clue. We can be only sure of the moment that we are in right now, right? So when something is absolutely not in your hand, why bother about that? So Swami would say, do the right thing that has to be done right now, and that will automatically take care of the future. There's nothing more you can do about the future. Just make the present perfect, right? So this brings up the question which often confuses us. I don't know about the listeners. It would often confuse me whenever Swami speaks about living in the present. Does that mean that we completely forget the past and be completely unconcerned about the future? Is that what living in the present means? You know, say, let me seize the moment and let me give myself to all the revelry and merrymaking. Is that what living in the present is about? Saying that I don't worry about tomorrow. And some people live their life like that. Who wants to save for tomorrow? And let's live our life today and let's make merry. Is that the kind of life, or completely forget about the past? There are many, many people who are suffering from all sorts of memory loss problems. There are people who have memory for only 5 minutes, or there are people who every day wake up with their memory wiped out when they wake up in the next morning. These are all documented cases, right? Does that mean that they are living in the present? Does that mean that you completely forget what happens in the past? So that's why I thought it's very important to understand what living in the present means. It does not mean completely being unconcerned about the past and the future. Swami says that the present is like a seed, right? And it's a beautiful idea of what a seed is. You know, if you look at it, here is this tiny seed which has come from this huge, massive tree. But in the seed, it contains all the wisdom of the seed, all the wisdom of this tree. You know, you have a tree which is, say, you know, if you go into the forests of Amazon and some of those very exotic forests, you have trees which grow really tall, right? Trees which grow probably up to 40 feet or even higher, maybe 60, 70 feet. You have these tall trees. And that tree, imagine it gives out this one seed. And in this tiny seed, which is not even 1% of the size of that tree, it contains the wisdom of that tree. It contains this entire code as to when it has to give out leaves, when it has to spread out its roots, and what it has to draw from the roots, what it has to draw through the leaves, when it has to start flowering. The idea of seasons is there in this little seed. So the entire wisdom of a huge tree is coded into this tiny seed, right? So that's why when Swami says, and it's not only the idea, the wisdom of this one tree, it's the the wisdom of evolution itself, right? Thousands and thousands of years, millions of years a tree takes to undergo the process of evolution. So all of this wisdom is contained in this one tiny seed. And at the same time, it's this seed which is going to one day become a tree of that size, right? Which means it contains the future too. It contains all the wisdom and knowledge of a past tree, as well as it contains all the vitality of a future tree. And that's what makes a seed very, very important. And that's why Swami akins the present to a seed, right? That's why it's Swami is giving so much more importance to the idea of the seed, because it contains the wisdom of the past and it contains the promise of the future. If not for that, the seed is nothing but a piece of dust, right? That's what makes this seed important. And similarly, that is what makes our present important, because this present represents the collective wisdom of all the past moments, right? And at the same time, what we do in the present moment is what is going to sprout as our future. So certainly the learning from the past has to be brought forward to enrich the present. Whatever we have learned, whatever knowledge we have collected, whatever experientially we have learned, is what makes this present, it enriches the present. It empowers you in the present to take the right decision, right? But if we were talking about worrying about the past or brooding about the past, that is when it weakens the present moment, right? It kind of makes you lose the opportunity of the present. So the idea is bring from the past that which enriches the present, and stop bringing from the past that which weakens your present moment. So brooding and regretting is a waste of the present opportunity. But repentance and resolving to make amends to mistakes that we've done in the past is a way by which we enrich the present, right? If you look at us in Radio Sai, we are constantly only talking about the past, right? We're talking about 1960s Swami did this, and 1940s Swami did this, 40 years back Swami did this, and he traveled to this place. So much so that I think one of the listeners wrote back to us that we are all stuck up in the past. Literally, he was a little upset with us. He said, you're all so stuck up in the past, you're not doing anything in the present. So much is happening in the Sai world. So many people are doing seva, you're not reporting all of that. You people seem to be stuck in the past. Well, I think to an extent what he said was right, but you know, the idea of going back to the past of especially somebody like Swami in life is, you know, when we think about Swami and think about Swami's actions and whatever Swami has spoken and whatever Swami has done, Swami says, my life is my message. That enriches what we are in the present moment, isn't it? So the learning and whatever is there from the past that we can bring, the wisdom from the past, empowers the present. And most certainly, that aspect of bringing the past is important, because that makes the present more, you use the present more better in that sense. Similarly, the future, you know, I have this seed in my hand, let's say, and I'm thinking that this seed is going to one day become a tree, and this tree which grows up into this huge tree, it's going to give up 1,000 more seeds, and each one of those 1,000 seeds are going to give me as many trees, and they are going to multiply. And then I think that at the end of 30, 40 years, I'm going to have a huge orchard, and then I can make this business, and I can probably open a natural park or whatever it is. Now, if I'm doing that, I'm actually daydreaming, right? That's what Swami would say. It's nothing but building castles in the air, right? Swami says dreaming like that and making plans is making you miss the moment. And that is what is not right when you're talking about getting lost in the future. Now, what you really have to do is you have the seed in your hand. All that you have to do is just plant that seed, water it, nurture it. The future will take care of itself. Whatever you're dreaming of is bound to happen by itself. And when that future becomes the present, we'll think about what we can do then. And that's what Swami says. So essence of what Swami is saying in this regard of living in the present is, do what is to be done right now in the present moment as perfectly as possible, without wasting time on brooding or, you know, over planning, right? That is the idea of what Swami says when Swami says, The present is omnipresent, and don't waste the present. That is the most important thing that Swami is trying to tell us, that don't waste this present worrying or over-planning. Just ensure that you're doing this present perfectly. And that's why even when I'm saying that we talk about Swami's past and all that, there's one way in which any form of sadhana, especially any form of devotional remembrance, makes the present perfect by itself. You don't think of, or you don't do any sadhana in the present with the idea of what it's going to give it to, give you in the future. Swami says that sadhana is not perfect. Sadhana is perfect if it is done just to fulfill that moment. So if we are lost in thoughts of Swami, I saw Swami 20 years ago, but I'm sitting today and thinking of Swami, it is not me being lost in the past and wasting this moment. This moment becomes complete in that contemplation. That is the essence of sadhana. I don't know, probably we'll touch upon that also towards the end. But coming back to this idea of what Swami says of living in the present and how you live in the present, this is actually the essence of what we refer to as karma yoga, isn't it? Right? Going back to that Gita Shloka and the other points that Swami mentions there, you know, the Gita Shloka says, anapeksha, remain non-attached to the outcome, right? That's the meaning of the word anapeksha. And Swami is saying, daksha. Daksha means skillfulness, right? To do whatever you're doing with utmost ability. Put all your abilities and bring the best of your possible. And Swami would say that, yoga karmasu kaushalam, right? Yoga is nothing but doing whatever you're doing perfectly. That itself is yoga. So Swami is saying that daksha, that idea of doing whatever you do perfectly, sarvarambha parityagi, that is nothing but one who has given up the endeavor for a certain result. It is not somebody who has stopped acting, but one who has stopped acting with a result in mind. That's what is the quality of sarvarambha parityagi. And finally, Swami says suchir. Suchir is purity, inner and outer purity, Swami would say, right? The last point that Swami makes, the point of suchir, is very important, because that's what decides what makes the present perfect. Now, if I were to think that life is all about pleasure seeking, then I will think that filling this moment, the present moment, with pleasure is what is making this moment perfect, right? That's the mistake that most of us tend to do. That, you know, why worry about the future? Why worry about the past? Let's enjoy in this moment. Because if we think that life is meant for enjoyment, then we will think that living in the present is living for pleasures and living for enjoyment. That's why the quality of suchir is very important. When you are pure enough to see the purpose of life, then you will try to ensure that the present is occupied with the purpose for which this present is given to you, right? And that is why all of these qualities represent, you know, you define living in the moment. It is making the best use of the present, enriching it with the wisdom from the past, and defining it with the highest purpose that it is heading to. And act in the present using all the faculties completely involved and employing all the skills that are at our disposal. Now, this idea of being completely involved, I think that is again something which we need to talk a little about, because that is also a very important aspect of living in the present. Because whenever we speak about living in the present, a word which we often tend to use is mindfulness, right? It's probably come from the Zen philosophy, where you're able to give all your concentration and abilities and thinking and all of that for that one act that you're doing. You're not letting your mind go all the way. And, you know, they talk about mindfulness in everything. Even if you're eating your meal, even if you're washing your clothes, even if you're just walking past the woods, all the thing, you do it as completely involved with all your abilities as possible. So that idea of doing it complete involvement with complete mindfulness is itself the idea of living in the moment. So when do we give our undivided attention to anything that we do? When is it that we give, I mean, we don't do everything with mindfulness, but we do a few things with mindfulness. What are those things that we tend to do with mindfulness? One is, if that activity is of immense interest to us, or if it is of complete importance to us. Right? If we give a lot of importance to a particular activity that we're doing, we'll automatically give all our attention to it and we'll do it perfectly, right? That's what, if there's something that we are fond of doing, that's what I'd refer to even in the last week's answer. One of the ways to be living in the present is do something that you like. You automatically get absorbed in that moment doing that activity. So one way is if you're doing something that you are very fond of or you think is very important. The other way that you tend to get drawn completely into an activity is when the situation forces you to focus like that. And what is the best example you can think of that? There's an examination tomorrow and you have a huge syllabus to cover. That pressure automatically makes you focus on what you're doing. If I have to talk from my point of view, if there's a talk this evening or if there's a talk tomorrow morning, automatically I shut myself from all the other distractions. I'm thinking about what am I going to convey tomorrow, and it becomes so very easy to focus. So the situation makes me so mindful in that sense, right? So when the situation is defining how much of our attention we give, actually it is defining our idea of the present itself. When I say present, the concept of present could be this very second. It could be this hour or it could be this day, right? I'm talking about today as the present, or I could be talking about this nanosecond as a present. It could be different, and this difference in our mind, how we perceive the present as, depends on, as I said, most often than not on the situation that we are in, right? Let's say it's a very leisurely weekend. We keep aside some kind of work for us and we want to just accomplish it. No, we spread it across the day and we do it at our leisure, right? There's no hurry in completing it, or there's no stress in completing it. I might have thought that I'll do 4 works in the afternoon, in the morning, and 4 other works in the afternoon, but I might end up doing only 2 in the morning, but I'm not really stressed out. I end up doing 6 in the evening and I complete the task, right? So it's just about a choice of how I spread the work around this day, which I call now, right now, right? I'm defining the present moment as today, and I have a certain work to finish it, and I don't mind how I spread it out across the work. But the same thing, we focus on the work when there is an emergency. Talk about, consider something like a medical emergency. When there's a medical emergency, or there's an accident that has occurred, they often refer to that 1 hour after an accident has happened as a golden hour. Because there are a lot of things that if in the form of first aid or in the form of some kind of medical assistance is given in that 1 hour, you have chances of saving that person's life, you know, any number of times more than you could. The chances are to save that person's life, say, 1 hour later or 2 hours later. Right? That's why they refer to that 1 hour as a golden hour. So in a situation like that, that becomes your present. I have 1 hour and I have to get myself to do all of these things, right? I have to get myself to finish all of these things. Or it may not necessarily be something, you know, so critical like that. I'm sure some of our mothers and sisters will be able to understand the idea of cooking. You know, when you're cooking, you have precise timelines, right? When something is boiling, you need to put something. When something is getting fried, you need to put something and get done with that. Right, you have precise moments where you have to finish certain tasks. When that is there, automatically it draws all your attention, it draws all your skills, all your thinking and all your reasoning. Everything is focused on that particular activity that you're doing. So many times we find that when under some kind of stress, right, when especially when you're in a situation where it calls our attention so very immediately, we automatically or without effort, we are actually living in that moment, right? The problem with this idea of living in the in dealing with stressful situations is, especially in modern day life, you know, we are living in a corporate life, a lot of deadlines to meet. You've got 2-3 things doing. There are some people who do 2-3 jobs. There are so many of our mothers who work and they come back and do it, work at home. All of these things, what it does is we are actually going from one stressful moment to the other, right? And when that happens, we are not able to focus on that particular activity which we do, because mean, at the end of the day, your mind really becomes tired. You're not able to give yourself completely to one particular activity that you're doing. And the reason for that is, I think we are not, as Swami would often call our attention to this, we are not practicing living in the present when there is no urgency in life. We are practicing living in the present, or rather we are not willfully practicing, we are forced to practice living in the present when we are going through these stressful situations in life. Let me give an example of, you know, how you can learn to practice this idea of living in the present, and that reflects when we are really in a situation where we are forced to live in the present. This is again an example I always find myself giving whenever I'm talking about focus, whenever I'm talking about practice and getting that focus in that one moment. Observe any sports person, or, you know, who's in highly competitive sports like cricket or tennis or football or basketball, or, you know, you have any number of these competitive sports where you have to make some very, very quick decisions in split seconds and also execute them, right? There are two abilities involved when you're talking about a sportsman who's in that situation. One is the ability to comprehend the situation completely and know what should be the response for that particular situation you're stuck in. And the second is the body should instantly follow the cue of the mind. Whatever the mind decides as the action that needs to be done at that precise moment, the body should be able to readily follow, right? So a sports person's training typically involves both of these. Complete control and sync between the mind and the body, and what is the appropriate response for each situation. These are the two things that a sportsman trains to inculcate, right? And this training happens, first of all, in leisure, right? In tennis, in cricket, we call it net practice. In tennis, you have the wall practice. So each one of these where you're put in a controlled environment, in a leisurely environment, and you learn to practice this. The coordination between the mind and the body, and the response for different situations. So first of all, you're put in a situation where you learn it leisurely, and then you're put in probably competitions which are not so important, right? They're not so very significant in your career, but they give you an opportunity to learn. We call that match practice in some of the games, right? So in this way, you're actually learning these two very important abilities, but you're learning it in leisure. And I think this is the challenge that we face in everyday life. When Swami would say that you should not think of the past and the future, live in the moment, we all do that when under stress, right? As I was explaining. And imagine any emergency situation, you're about to hit a vehicle on the road or any impulsive action that you have to perform. At such a time, your mind is forced to dwell in that moment and not think about the past and think about the future. In fact, the biological process in the body is that it cuts the mind from connecting to the past and the future. It has to draw whatever it can from that present moment, what the mind can think, right? So your mind is forced to dwell in that moment alone, and it does not have the time and ability to think about the past or the future. So the whole challenge is, can we ensure that we will do the most perfect action and make the most precise decision even when our concept of now has become so very pinpoint in the case of an emergency or you're driving on the road, right? It sounds like something mumbo-jumbo I'm saying, but we don't realize that this is what we do. This is what we do when we learn to drive a car. This is what we do when we started learning to drive a bicycle. This is what we did when we learned to even try to walk, right? These are the things which we've learned effortlessly. In leisure, you learn what is the right thing to do in different situations, and you keep practicing it so much, it becomes so much a part of you that you start doing it spontaneously. So when we're talking about the spiritual path and living in the now, the question is, in other words, can we become spontaneously noble, right? Can we do the right thing at any given opportunity, at any given situation, even if we cannot draw from the past and the future at that particular moment, right? And this can only be achieved if in leisure we practice doing the right thing, right? Going back to the example of the sportsmen and how they carry themselves about. Observe any professional sports person, you know, who is doing something very leisurely, right? You know, at a moment, you know, when they're playing a game, like when the rally is going on in a tennis, that's a different thing. Or when the rally is going on in a shuttle badminton match, that's a different thing. But observe them when they are between the rallies, or in a cricket match when a bowler has finished his bowling and he's walking back to his run-up. At that moment of leisure, if you were to observe the way they collect the ball or pick up the shuttlecock or how they dribble about the ball, you know, be it a football or a basketball or whatever it is, you would find that in that leisure they will not even be making any effort to properly catch a ball or lift a ball up. They would do it so effortlessly, because I think in many ways you can see that they've mastered the art of responding in a critical time with the right response, and doing it under no stress situation becomes all the more easy, right? So they're constantly doing the right thing, responding the right way to if suddenly a ball is thrown at them, or if they want to pick up the ball for something. When there is no stress, when they are at leisure, even at that time, they find this, the body mind, the coordination is so perfect, and their response to different situation becomes so very effortless. I think that's what Swami expects when we're talking about goodness, right action, the performance of our dharma, where, you know, it requires no deliberation from our past. You know, we don't think about what happened in our past or what is going to be the result. You will be effortlessly doing what is the right thing to be done at that moment. So to achieve that, first of all, as Swami says, purity and unity of thought, word and deed. That's when you have this perfect sync between what you think and what you do and what you say. And the ability to completely focus in the moment, only bringing forward the lessons from the past if necessary, and considering the future only to define perfectly what is the role of the present, right? And when we do this in leisure, and when we are doing it, as Swami would say, again, quoting from the Bhagavad Gita, Swami would say, Abhyasa and Vairagya, Swami would say, are two important tools on the spiritual path. When you constantly practice this, living in the present at a leisurely time, even when you're doing something very mundane, if you're able to focus all your, you know, faculties in that particular act that you're doing, there's no emergency which is making you do that, but you're doing that willfully as a practice, Swami says, you start making more and more of your present moments perfect, right? And I think this is where the second question that you spoke about comes into picture, right? You asked about meditation. What happens when we start meditating? Swami would often say that meditation is a three-step process. Again, I've spoken a couple of times about this idea of meditation. Swami would say it's concentration, contemplation, and meditation, right? And concentration is the ability to focus on one thing at a time. Swami would say from multi-pointedness, you bring your mind to this one-pointedness, your ability to think about one thing, focus on one thing, right? So when we start the process of meditation, the first step is concentration, right? But contemplation, Swami says, is the ability to completely detach yourself from the surrounding and focus. It's a little higher than concentration. Concentration is everything is around you, but you choose to focus on one thing. Swami says contemplation is you literally remove yourself from everything around. That's what Swami would, you know, give an example of Arjuna when he's taking focus on his target. He says, I can't see anything else. I'm seeing only the target. That's because it's a very advanced stage of concentration. It is a form of concentration, but you are not choosing to concentrate. You've literally gone past that state and where you're seeing only what needs to be seen, right? So it's one step higher than concentration. And of course, meditation is completely different. I'll come to that in a bit, because that is what will also complete the answer about what it is to live in the present. But this contemplation is probably the kind of mindfulness which is required to be absolutely absorbed in that moment, right? Going back to the example of the sportsman, many of the sportsmen often speak about what they refer to as being in the zone or being in an alpha state, where they are not actually thinking. They're just in that situation, and they seem to be playing the right stroke. They seem to be, their hands go up in the right form to take a catch or whatever it is. They spontaneously respond without having any thinking to do, right? That's almost like the contemplation state. And that's what Swami would say when we, when we speak about meditation, we often reach this contemplative state where we are kind of removed from what is happening around us and we are able to dwell completely on what you're meditating upon, right? And this probably I'll use to explain what you asked about what happens when we are meditating. Almost none of us really go to that state of meditation which Swami speaks about, right? When Swami speaks about meditation, Swami would say, it's a state where the one who meditates, the dhyata, the form being meditated upon, the dhyaya and the process of meditation, dhyana, merge into one, right? Swami would say that that is a state of meditation. And Swami would say that, you know, sages and saints have been meditating for hundreds of years to attain that state of meditation. Don't think that by sitting 10 minutes a day, you're going to go into that meditation. And in fact, there's a very beautiful story which one of our students shared with us, one of our alumni, where Swami called some boys for an interview and Swami asked in the interview, do any of you practice meditation, right? And he was saying that the senior boys knew that what was Swami's definition of meditation. So they were a little hesitant to talk about meditation and what is meditation. They were scared to say that we meditate, but there was this one fresher in that group who had no clue and he told Swami that, Swami, you know, I meditate. And Swami looked at him and said, oh, you meditate? That's so wonderful. So how long do you meditate? Swami asked him. And this boy very innocently said, Swami, I meditate about 10-20 minutes a day. And Swami said, oh, you meditate for 20 minutes a day? And Swami said, you do not pata, if you really meditate, you will not know how much time you have meditated. Right? So Swami would say that that is really the state of meditation. So none of us really go to that state. And if you're talking about that state, you become one with the inner self. Right? That's what Swami says. The one you meditate upon and the one who meditates becomes one. So where is the question of we listening to the inner self or seeing the inner self? We become merged with the inner self when you're talking about the highest form of meditation. But the contemplation aspect is what something most of us tend to be able to touch upon, right? So Swami says when you're in that meditative state where you're contemplating effortlessly, that is a state where you're able to still your mind, you're able to control the roamings of the mind. So in that state, your mind becomes clarified and you're able to see what is the right thing to do. You're able to discern what the conscience is pointing you out. So in that sense, it only creates a situation around us where it is easier to make contact with that inner self. It's not necessarily that when you're meditating, you'll hear a voice from inside or you'll see an effulgent form, which is your inner self. According to Swami, it's nothing like that. You only prepare your mind to be in a state where you be the best you can, right? That's why I was saying the contemplation is something like the alpha state a sportsman reaches, because that's the best that sportsman or the sportswoman can be. With all the training, they become that best in that few moments when they are in a very contemplative state. So in that sense, when we go into this deep contemplation, that's our best opportunity to be as close to the inner self as possible, but it doesn't mean that you will hear the voice or, you know, see the form. Like Swami would pretty much dismiss any of such experiences that people would share that I saw this light within or anything like that. If Swami chooses to give an experience like that, it's none of our business to comment about that. But Swami would say that don't look for any experience like that when you're meditating. It's not like you'll hear a voice or you'll see a form. Now, before I conclude, I think I'm almost done. I just want to, just for probably the academic purpose, I'm going to speak about the idea of now, which is more than this. I gave much of the time to about the idea of living in the present because I said this is what Swami says when he's referring to the idea of living in the present and that's what's important to us. But you should understand this concept of the present, which is distinct from the past and the future, the concept of now, the concept of right now, this moment, itself is nothing but one form of a concept of time, isn't it? The idea of a time, we are seeing time as a continuum, and we are talking of the present as one slice in that continuum of time. The idea of time itself is actually under the mind, right? So all of what we talk about living in the present, living in the moment, is under the influence of this ego, under the influence of this mind, right? there's this very beautiful description or the definition of time in Advaita. I don't know which exactly is the text from this, from which this definition comes, but the definition is so very beautiful, and the definition is true. That's what Swami speaks about. I don't know the source of this line, where it says, avidya chit samyogaha kalaha. It's a definition of time or kalaha. It says, what is kala? Avidya chit samyogaha. When you have avidya and chit or consciousness, the mix of these two or one superimposed over the other is the concept of time. This idea of chit, Swami says, is nothing but existence, right? It is that's the eternal present in that sense. There is no past or present, or there is no question of thinking about the past or future, because there is only present in that, because there is no concept of time when you go beyond the mind. The simplest way of understanding that is, as Swami says, when you sleep, when you're in a dream, the concept of time goes. When you go into deep sleep, the concept of even partial time is completely gone, right? You have no idea of how much time you have slept, especially when you go into that very deep sleep, or what Swami would refer to as Sushupti. So the idea of time itself is under this concept of body consciousness or ego or the mind. So this definition from Advaita says that when this consciousness is superimposed or is brought together, samyogaha is coming together of this consciousness and avidya. Avidya is nothing but ignorance. Ignorance that I am this individual or I am this body. That is what produces the concept of time. And from the concept of time, this concept of now and later and before and the past and all of that comes, right? And one of the most beautiful description you can think of is, again, Swami has also spoken about this. Imagine there is a light producing object, you know, like a projector. A projector is nothing but something which projects light through a small opening, right? And what is it that we call a movie projection? It is nothing but a film which is running at 25 frames per second or something like that. And this movement of this different frames in front of this light is what creates this illusion of, oh, there are different characters and this is happening and this drama happening, so-and-so is suffering, so-and-so is fighting. All of this is created because the source of light in front of it is superimposed these series of images. So in Advaita, they talk of it as, you know, the source of light is chit, is consciousness. And when this source of light is made to flow through this tiny idea of body consciousness or ego, that is what creates this avidya, what we are all living in, which is nothing but the wakeful state. We are seeing, you know, I am speaking and you're all listening, and after me somebody is going to come and speak, and after this tomorrow you're going to go and meet somebody. All of this is nothing but avidya, which is superimposed over this consciousness. So this concept of now, when we are talking about the now beyond the mind, that now is actually timeless. There is only now. There is no concept of living in the now, because once you transcend the mind, there is only now. And that is why Swami was saying that if you hit the state of meditation, if you go beyond contemplation and you hit the state of meditation, there is no way you're going to have an idea of time. You're not going to be able to say that I meditated for so much time, right? That is the concept of chit, or as I was saying, that there is a close relationship between our idea of now and our idea of existence. So our idea of existence or consciousness, which flows through our body consciousness, creates this idea of my past, my present, and my future. And in this past, present, and future, Swami says the best way to live is if you're able to focus on every moment, making that moment perfect. That is the best way to live. And in a sense, that mindfulness itself, Swami would say that, you know, even when Swami is speaking about meditation, Swami would say that if you're able to hold yourself, you know, that dharana of so many minutes or so many seconds, Swami would say, if you're able to do, you go into dhyana, and if you're able to do dhyana for so many minutes, then you'll end up in samadhi, where you go beyond the mind and you're in the timeless state, right? So when we are able to do this mindfulness in every activity that we do, it's not easy. It takes a lot of effort to concentrate. And believe me, I'm telling it with absolute experience, that it's so difficult to concentrate on what you do. and give all your attention to one particular thing that you do. And Swami says that practice that every day. You might be cooking, you might be washing your clothes, you might be reading a book, you might be speaking to a person, you might be listening to a person. Try as much as possible to be there in that moment. And when you string a lot of such moments like that, you're practicing to live every moment perfectly. And Swami says, eventually, you'll get into that state where you go beyond the mind. Once you go beyond the mind, as Swami would say, you know, when you go into a theater, you see different scenes being depicted on a white wall. It's because the light is coming through this small orifice on the wall. So Swami is saying, the moment all the lights are switched on, the room is flooded with light, then there are no forms in front of you. There are no forms which are doing different things in front of you, right? So that is why this concept of living in the present is very important, and it starts from something very simple as not worrying about the past and not dreaming too much about the future, to this concept of mindfulness, which is another form of meditative state. And if you're able to string as many moments of mindfulness, we can go beyond the state and touch upon this. We have that ability to be in that deep sleep state. And that's what I believe it's Ramana Maharshi who says, that the ability to be in deep sleep when you're awake is samadhi, right? So to be able to live in that state, it's nice to talk about. It's going to take a lot of effort. At least for me, I'm sure it is. But this is how it is. And that's why this concept of living in the present is so very important. So thank you, Sister Yasha, for asking that question. I hope I've given you more clarity now than the answer that I'd given last time. It was a very, very brief answer. But still, if you have anything more to ask, feel free to ask me. I'd love to explain more either in person, I mean, through mail or through a program if it solicits that. With that, dear listeners, it's time for me to wrap up. I took a little more extra time than before. I think I always do that nowadays. Sorry for that. I know my answers are becoming very, very long, and a couple of people have come up to me and told that your answers are nice, but they're very long. In the effort to be as comprehensive as I can, I think I'm stretching it so much. I'm sorry about that, but there's so much to learn from Swami's message and there's so much to discuss. So I'm very, very grateful for this opportunity. If you have a question which we could discuss on this program, feel free to write to me. I invite mails to my personal mail ID. That's prem@radiosai.org, prem@radiosai.org. I'm going to leave you with a very, very beautiful song on the Guru, one of my favorite songs on the Guru. I'm sure you would like this too. Tomorrow's Guru Purnima, advanced Guru Purnima greetings to all of you. After the song, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of the day, the Vahini Satsang. I'll meet you all next week, 7:30 p.m. with the next episode of Radio Sai.